I say unto you, lecture number 15, 6th of November, 1977, at the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh Ashram, Pune. Bhagwan. And one of the Pharisees desired him that he would eat with him. And he went into the Pharisee's house and sat down to meat. And, behold, a woman in the city, which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment, and stood at his feet behind him weeping, and began to wash his feet with tears, and did wipe them with the hairs of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee, which had bidden him to saw it, he spake within himself, saying, This man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is, that touches him, for she is a sinner. And Jesus answering said unto him, Simon, I have somewhat to say unto thee. And he saith, Master, say on. There was a certain creditor which had two debtors. The one owed 500 pence, and the other 50. And when they had nothing to pay, he frankly forgave them both. Tell me therefore, which of them will love him most? Simon answered and said, I suppose that he to whom he forgave most. And he said unto him, Thou hast rightly judged. For I say unto thee, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loveth little. And he said unto her, Thy sins are forgiven. And they that sat at meat with him began to say within themselves, Who is this that forgiveth sins also? And he said to the woman, Thy faith has saved thee. Go in peace.
Who is Jesus Christ? The question has been asked down the centuries again and again, and it has been answered too. But the questioners were wrong, and so were those who have answered it. Because the question was out of a certain prejudice. And so was the answer. They were not essentially different. Their source was one and the same. The question was asked by those who were suspicious of Jesus' godhood. And the question was answered by those who were not ready to believe Jesus' manhood. They were only ready to believe half of him. The Jews were ready to believe that he is a man. And the Christians were ready to believe that he is God. The Jews were denying half of him, the Jesus power. The Christ part. And the Christians were denying the other half, the Jesus part. Who is Jesus Christ? Christians don't want to see him as Jesus, Son of Man. Man of flesh, blood and bones. Man as other men are. And Jews did not want to believe him as God, as divine, made of pure consciousness, not of flesh, blood and bones. Nobody has been ready to believe Jesus in his totality. And that is not only the case with Jesus, that is the case with all the masters. Buddha, Krishna, Mahavira, Zarathustra. And unless you allow Jesus in his totality to penetrate you, you will not be transformed. Unless you allow him as he is, you will not be in contact with him. Jesus is both Jesus and Christ. And he is not ashamed of it. In the Bible, many times he says, I am the Son of Man. And as many times he also says, I am the Son of God. And he seems to have no idea that there is any contradiction between these two. There is none. The contradiction exists in our minds. It doesn't exist in Jesus' being. His being is bridged. His being is bridged between time and eternity, body and soul, this world and that. His being is bridged between the visible and the invisible, the known and the unknown. He is utterly bridged. He is at ease with both. Because he is both. Jesus and Christ are like two swords, and only the river is possible if there are two swords. Jesus is the river that flows between these two swords. Both swords are his. He exists between them. He is the river. Who is Jesus Christ, God or man? And I say all the questions that have been asked were wrong, and so were the answers. Why? Because the questions came either from Judaic knowledge, or from Muslim knowledge, or from Hindu knowledge. And the answers came from Christian knowledge. And knowledge cannot answer it. Knowledge cannot even ask it. Knowledge is important. Such questions of such importance can be asked only out of innocence, not out of knowledge. The distinction has to be understood. When you ask a question out of knowledge, you are not really asking, because you already know. Your question is false, inauthentic. Your heart is not there. You are asking for asking's sake, maybe for a discussion, a debate, an argument. But you know the question beforehand. The answer is there a priori. So you cannot receive the answer. You are not open for it. You are not available for it. You are not ready to move, to explore. You have already the answer. And the question is arising out of that answer. Jews had the answer. They knew that he is not the Messiah. That he is not God. Why? Because they had the idea that when the Messiah comes, everybody will recognize him. Everybody, without any exclusion. That was their idea of Messiah, that everybody will recognize him. And Jesus is not recognized by everybody. How he can be the Messiah? They have a definition. They had also believed, that was also has been their knowledge, that when Jesus, the real Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah comes, everybody will be liberated immediately. all past sins, present sins will simply disappear into that light. And it has not happened. Christ is there, but people are not liberated yet. They are still living in sin. They are still living in misery. So this man cannot be the Messiah, cannot be the Christ. This is not the man they were waiting for. These are prejudices. They have never seen any Messiah. How can they define what will happen when the Messiah comes? For example, if you have an idea in the dark night of your soul that when the morning comes, money will shower from the sky. When the sun rises, everybody will become rich. And then in the morning when sun rises, how can you accept that this is the sun? Because the money is not falling. And everybody has not become rich. People are still poor. And you go on looking at the sky and no money is coming. And because you are too much concerned with the money, you don't see what is coming from the sun, the light, the life, the ecstasy. You cannot see that because your eyes are completely covered with your prejudice, with your idea. And then you ask, who is this Jesus Christ? You know already how the Messiah should be. And that is hindering. That is an obstruction. That's why Jews missed. It is for this man that they have been waiting for centuries. And when he came and knocked on their doors, they missed. They denied. How they denied? Were they bad people? No, they were as good people as you are. They were as good as Hindus and Mohammedans and Buddhists. There was nothing wrong with them. Then what was the problem? The problem is their knowledge. They had a prejudice. And when Christians answer that Jesus is the only begotten Son of God, again it is knowledge. What I want to say to you is that the questions and the answers are coming from the same source. They are not different. They are not a little bit different. Christians say he is the only begotten Son of God. Now this is stupid. Because all comes from God. So how Jesus can be exclusively the Son of God? Everybody is the Son of God. We all partake of sonhood. God is our Father. And that's what Jesus goes on saying again and again. But Christians won't listen. They have an idea that God has sent His only Son. Why only? Too much afraid that He may have another Son to send, and the other Son may come, and then there will be conflict. Then who is right? So make it sure, certain, that He has only one Son. So you are finished. Once the Bible has come, now there will be no more any Bible coming again. Mohammedans say, Muhammad is the only prophet, the last prophet. Now there will be no more coming. He has brought the ultimate. So nobody can improve upon the Quran. Nobody can improve upon the Bible because nobody has the right to improve. Why the only begotten Son? Are not trees and the rivers and the mountains and the stars and man and animals and birds not created by God? Don't this whole existence come from God? Is it not flowing from His being? God is the totality of all. rocks and rivers and mountains are as much His creations as you are, as Jesus is. There is no distinction. All beings participate in God. In fact, to be is to participate in God. Otherwise you cannot be. There is no other way to be. To be is to be God. Then what is the difference between you and Jesus? The difference is not of your being. The difference is only of your knowing, recognition, awareness. Jesus knows that He is the Son of God and you have not yet recognized it. That's the only difference. You can recognize any moment. In that very recognition, the transformation. What Jesus calls metanoia. It is only a question of recognition. You have become oblivious of your reality. He is aware. But there is no difference between the beings. You are as rich as He is. He knows, you don't know. Because you don't know, you remain poor. Not because you are poor. You are not poor. How you can be poor when God is sovereign every moment on you? When He is beating in your heart and circulating in your blood and flowing into your consciousness, how you can be poor? You are not beggars. Everybody is an emperor. But you are not aware of the fact. You don't look inside yourself where God goes on making contact with you. You don't look into your source. The word to look into your source that Jesus uses is return. That return word has been translated as repent. Repent also means return, but it has fallen into wrong associations. It has become repentance. It has nothing to do with repentance. Return. Turn into your own being. 180-degree turn, and suddenly you see the light that you have always been. You see the light that you are. You see God. And for the first time you recognize that you have never lost track of Him. Just He was behind your back. You were not looking at Him. It is as if the sun has risen and you are standing in full morning with closed eyes. Just open your eyes. Jesus is standing just by your side with open eyes. And you are standing with closed eyes. That's the only difference. There is no other difference. Jesus is man because you are God. Let me tell you what I mean. Jesus is as much man as you are man, and you are as much God as Jesus is God. God and man are not two separate entities. Man is one of the forms of God's expression into the world. Jesus is man and God, so you are. And to understand Jesus is to understand your own situation. And to love Jesus is to love your own being. To meditate on Jesus is to meditate upon your own division, the gap that has come into your being between you and your own real self. To understand Jesus is to bridge that gap. Jesus has no privilege over you. Neither has Buddha. nobody is privileged. Otherwise, God would be unjust. Everybody has the same powers. In the eyes of God, we are all equal. Inequality is our creation. In God's eyes, everyone is equal to everything else. Jews were very much disturbed because Jesus was claiming that he is God, our God's son. Christians for the 2000 years have been defending Jesus, that he was God, that he is God. And they have been trying to efface all possibilities so that it can be proved that he is man. That's why I say he was born out of a virgin mother. That is the beginning. So they deny his manhood. So he is not just like you. He is special. Even in his birth, he is special. Then they try to make his life in such a way that no indications are left that he is human. He is very human. Utterly human. He was a total man. He is not a perfectionist. When it is needed to be angry, he becomes really angry. He threw the money changers out of the temple and he said to them, "What are you doing here in my father's home? In my father's temple? Get out from here." And he was such a rage that alone, single-handed, he threw many people outside. He loved people. He has friends. He mixed with people. He ate with people, drank with people. He moved with people. He lived like an ordinary man. He had no pretensions of anything extraordinary. And even if something extraordinary happens, he always says, "It is your faith that has done the miracles. It is God's mercy on you. It is something between you and your God." He does not expect even gratitude. Somebody is very grateful because a miracle has happened and he has been cured, and he wants to touch his feet and thank him, and he says no, and he says, "You are a great man, you are so good." And Jesus says, "Nobody is good except God. You thank him. You forget about me. It is your faith that has cured you, not I." And if you have to be thankful, you have to be thankful to God. Forget about me. Don't allow me to be between you and your God. That's exactly what Buddha is reported to have said to his disciples. "If you meet me on the way, kill me immediately. Never allow me to stand between you and the reality. Hold my hands as far as you are not capable of walking alone on your own. The moment you are capable of walking alone and on your own, just forget about me. Go ahead. Then don't cling to me. Then don't try to remain a shadow of me. If you meet me on the way, kill me immediately," he says. That's what Jesus goes on saying again and again. "Forget about me. Let your thanks go directly to God. Who am I?" Christians have been trying to efface all traces of his humanity. So he is born out of a virgin Mary, a virgin mother, which is absolutely absurd. Then he lives a life in which all human traits are removed. Christians only talk about his miracles, not about his ordinary life. They are afraid. Christians say Jesus never laughed. Now this seems to be the ultimate in stupidity. Jesus and never laughed, then who else can laugh? But laughter seems too human, too mundane. They cannot allow Jesus to laugh. But Jesus' life is such, he must have been laughing. He must have been really laughing. He must have been a man of laughter, because he says again and again, rejoice. Be merry. Celebrate. These words cannot come from a man who has never laughed. And a man who has never laughed, why he should go to parties? Why he should drink with people? Why he should be mixing with people? And he was a mixer. Every day, every night, he was moving with people. He was not secluded. He must have been really laughing and enjoying. But Christians say he never laughed. They have made his picture very sad looking, long face, burdened. This is not possible. This is utterly wrong, because it goes against the basic realization of a Christ, of a Buddha. Because a man who has attained to ultimate consciousness will be completely blissful, cheerful. His life will be a song and a dance. It will have the quality of flowers and stars. It can't be said. Why he should be said? It is his father's world. It is his God's world. Why he should be said? He has come home. When he is going to be happy? If you are not happy even by knowing God, then there is no possibility. Jesus looks so sad. He has been painted sad. He has been painted as the Savior. He has been painted as if he is carrying the burdens of everybody and sins of everybody. He forgives you. He does not carry your burden. He simply forgives you. This is the wrong standpoint, that he takes his burden upon himself. If it is not worth, why he should take upon himself? And if it is so valuable, why he should take it from you? He will put some more on you. No, he is not taking anybody's burden. He is simply helping everybody to drop it. Because it is you who are holding and clinging to it. It is valueless. When he says you are forgiven, he says forget all about your sadnesses and forget about all about hell. It is your father's world, and he is compassion, and he is love. How can love punish you? How can love throw you in hell? How can love torture you? God is not a sadist. And then Christians say, resurrection. Their whole Jesus depends on three things. First, a virgin birth. Second, a non laughing, non-enjoying, monotonous sad life of miracles. And third, resurrection. These are the three things that seem to be important to them. And these are all useless. Because they miss the whole point. The real Jesus is missed. This is a myth that Christians have created around him. And because of this myth, the real Jesus is lost. I would like to tell you, he is the real man, authentic man. He lived like a man. And he loved living like a man. He lived in all dimensions of manhood. And yet he is God. Now there are people, strange people. Just the other night I was reading a Christian theologian, T.L.J. Altizer. He holds that God has ceased to be God in becoming a man, Jesus. The incarnation is the death of God in his divine being. In short, God is dead and Jesus is his son. Altizer says, God died because he became Jesus. There are people who are against that Jesus is the incarnation of God. They look like enemies. Because they say, how God can incarnate himself in such a small body? How the infinite can come to the finite? And how the eternal can enter into time? They have their logic. How the infinite can be contained in a small body? It is not possible. Because God is so great and Jesus is so small, they say it is not possible. Now look at the other side. Now this is a Christian theologian. He says, forget about God. God died the day Jesus was born. He became Jesus. God exists no more. Now Jesus is God. This is another extreme. First, the enemy does not allow God to incarnate because how he can incarnate? His logic is also the same. He denies Jesus' godhood. To oppose this man, people like Altizer are there. They are ready to kill God to make Jesus a perfect God. Now God has disappeared into Jesus. He lives no more. These are not the right ways to bridge. Either God has to die or Jesus has not to be a God. My understanding, my vision is totally different. God descends not only in Jesus, but in everybody. This incarnation is not only for once. It is everyday incarnation. When a child is born to you, God is incarnated. When a seed sprouts, God is incarnated. When a son is born, God is incarnated. When a flower blooms, God blooms. It is only God. There is nothing else. Existence is synonymous with God. And God can go on incarnating in millions and millions of forms. He remains inexhaustible. That's what the Upanishads say. They say, you can take out of the perfect as much as you want, but the perfect remains the perfect. You can take it completely out of it, and yet the whole remains intact behind. That is the meaning of the infinite. If you take something from the infinite, and the infinite becomes a little lesser, then it was not infinite in the first place. The definition of the infinite is you can take as much as you want, but you cannot exhaust it. God goes on being born and remains unexhausted. And there are poor thinkers like Althusser who think God is exhausted with Jesus. That too is a very, very cunning device. So no more anybody can be born as Christ. So no more Buddha, no more Mahavira. With Jesus, God is finished. The doors are closed. God is dead. Because Jesus is there. God has become Jesus, so God cannot remain as God. In short, to put the whole philosophy of Althusser, I would like to say, he is saying God is dead and Jesus is his son. The Father need not die in the Son. The Father can give birth to many sons. You will be surprised, an ordinary father, a human father. How many sons a human father can give birth to, do you know? Millions. One single couple, if allowed time, can populate the whole world. That's how it has happened, Adam and Eve, one single couple. And they have populated the whole world. One single seed, and the whole earth will become green. Just time is needed. An ordinary man will make at least 4,000 intercourses in his life. Ordinary. Very ordinary. Those who go more in love, they can make more. 8,000, 10,000, or even more. But normal, average is 4,000 intercourses. In each single intercourse, do you know how many cells are released? Millions. And each single cell can become a human being. Multiply 4,000 with millions. A single human father can give birth to the whole earth. What to say about the ultimate father? Althusser's God seems to be very poor. A single incarnation and he dies. And he disappears. But there is a cunning trick in it, so that Jesus becomes God and nobody else can become God again. So Jesus remains the only begotten Son. I would like to say to you, Jesus is beautiful. He is divine because everybody else is also beautiful and everybody else is also divine. The difference is of recognition, not of existence. The difference is only of knowledge, not of ontology. Jesus Christ is both Jesus and Christ. He is Christ in Jesus and he is Jesus in Christ. He is the meeting point where two worlds meet. Where two utterly polar worlds meet. And hence the beauty and hence the ecstasy of Jesus. Ecstasy always arises when two polarities meet. Bigger the polarities, bigger the distance between the polarities, bigger the ecstasy. That's how, while you are making love to a woman, there is great joy. Because two polarities meet. Not very big polarities. because a man and woman are not very far away, not very distant, but still distant. When a man and woman meet and are lost into love, there is great ecstasy. There is great joy. Because they are dissolved. The egos are lost. Boundaries are no more valid. They are overlapping, overflowing into each other. Their ordinary mundane worries don't make any sense in this moment of joy. This orgasmic moment, how it arises, it is the meeting of the polarities. What to say about Jesus meeting Christ, Gautama meeting Buddhahood, man meeting God? Those are the ultimate polarities. As far away as possible, infinite meeting finite. The very meeting is ultimate in celebration. Jesus must have been ecstatic because of the Christian painting, Christian ideology. He looks very sad. He must have been a man of great joy, overflowing with delight. What else is possible when the light has happened inside, delight has to happen outside. They go together. When the house is lighted, even with closed windows, travelers can see the light falling outside, from the curtains, from the doors. That is delight. When light has happened inside, people can see from the outside something immensely valuable flowing. That is the definition of ecstasy. Polarities meeting. Man ordinarily is like a person living in sleep. Not aware who he is. When God's energy touches him, when he is available to God's energy, when he is receptive to God's energy, when that stirring energy comes dancing into him, there is ecstasy. There is no ecstasy unless we join the mundane with the supramundane. The mud with the sun, the earth with the sky, the body with soul, the matter with mind. Only then, where sun and the mud meet, the lotus is born, the lotus of ecstasy. Unless reality is as miraculous as the supposedly miraculous, we are frozen in ice. Man as man is a frozen thing. And let me say to you, God as God is also a frozen thing. So it is not only that you are seeking God. God is also seeking you. It is not only that without God you are sad. God is also sad without you. And when you will meet with God and God will meet with you, it will not be only your ecstasy. It will be His ecstasy too. The whole existence will feel ecstatic. Whenever a single human being becomes a Christ or a Buddha, the whole existence dances. The whole existence is overjoyed. Goes mad with ecstasy. Meeting is the melting of the divisions. Thinking yourself as man is creating a division. And if you don't drop this division, this category that you have created around you, that I am a man, you will not allow God to enter in you. You have to be completely free from boundaries, from all boundaries. The boundary of the Hindu, the boundary of the Christian, the boundary of man, the boundary of richness, poorness, education, uneducation, the boundary of white and black, the boundary of the Brahmin and the Sudra, all the boundaries has to be dropped. In that very dropping, the eternal enters into your time world. Into your dark night of the soul comes that light, floods that light, and suddenly you are no more the same. And let me repeat, God is also no more the same. God was never so rich as he became rich after Christ. He was never so rich as he became after Buddha. He is not so rich as he will become rich when you meet him, because you will pour into him. I know you have a small energy only, but an ocean is created by small drops falling. Small rivers flow into the ocean and create the ocean. No single river can create the ocean, but each single river goes on creating it, goes on helping it. God is bigger than ever, every day, because some waters, some river again flows into him, again brings a new life, a new thrill. God is evolving. God is not a static thing. God is evolving every moment. Meeting is the melting of the boundaries, blurring of the divisions, overlapping, overflowing. This is what is called trust, or faith, or surrender. At absolute zero, absolute surrender, life takes over once more, and we are returned to God, or to Tao, or to Dhamma, to free-flowing totality. God is free-flowing totality. God is not a person. To our pure being, we return only when we also become a free-floating totality. In this state, everything is okay, right? A rusting tin can fills us with radical awe as the sunlight catches it. In yoga, they call it a certain state of nadam, a certain state of harmony, accordance. When man disappears into God and man's conflict with God disappears, there is nadam, there is harmony. What Heraclitus calls the hidden harmony. Nadam is homeostasis, harmony, rhythm. You are out of rhythm, out of tune with God. That is your misery. Jesus is in tune with God. That is his joy. If he is also miserable, and if he is also sad, then what is the difference between you and him? The difference is that he feels for you, that he feels all compassion for you, but he himself is in utter joy. In fact, because he is in utter joy, he feels sorry for you, he feels compassion for you. He also wants you to bring to this utter joy, and he knows it is yours just for the asking. Hence he says, ask and it shall be given. Seek and you shall find. Knock and the door shall be opened unto you. These sutras. And one of the Pharisees desired him that he would eat with him. And he went into the Pharisee's house and sat down to meat. Jesus was always ready to go anywhere, to anybody. He wanted as many people to come into his contact as possible. He never missed a single opportunity of contacting people. Before we go further into the sutras, few things about Jesus' way, his work, how he transformed many people. What was his secret? What was his alchemy? Have to be understood. Remember these seven words. Christ means to me these seven words. And this is his whole catalytic. Second, catalepsy. Third, catharsis. Fourth, catastrophe. Fifth, cross. Sixth, conversion. And seventh, Christ consciousness. This is his whole alchemy. How you use to transform people. His work is different than Buddha. His methodology is different. Different from Krishna, different from Muhammad. He is a unique master. First, catalytic. Jesus' work is that of a catalytic agent. He wants people to be in contact with him. What Hindus call satsanga, to be in the contact with the master, to be in the presence of the master. The very presence functions. Jesus does not give methods to people. That is not his way. Patanjali's way is to create devices, methods. That is the way of Gurdjieff too. To create methods and devices so people can start growing. Jesus' way is that of satsanga. He transforms people just by his touch. He overpowers people. He surrounds them. His energy starts dancing around them. He starts pulsating his being. And in his pulse, that powerful pulse of Jesus, the other person also starts pulsating. In the beginning, hesitant, afraid, not knowing where he is going, but slowly, slowly gains momentum. It is like a dancer. Have you not watched when a dancer is dancing and the music is on? Something of the dance starts happening in you. Your feet start moving. You start tipping your chair with the hand. Your head starts nodding. You are filled with it. Some pulsation has reached you. Jesus' methodology is to pulsate people through his pulse. To magnetize people through his magnetism. To be with them. And the best way to be with them is when they are very, very relaxed. Hence, Jesus is always ready to go to people to drink with them, to eat with them. Because that is the most relaxing moment in people's life. Buddha has never done that. That was not his way. When people are eating, they are relaxed. Have you not watched it? Even businessmen like you to take for a lunch, because then things are easier. You are more positive. You are more relaxed. You say yes more easily. So the salesman, if he wants to sell the car to you, takes you for a lunch. When your belly is feeling good, and you are feeling very contented, and the aroma of the food, and the joy of the food, and you are feeling really satisfied, it is very difficult to say no. It is easier for the salesman to sell something to you. And Jesus is the greatest salesman. It is not just accident that his religion has become the greatest religion as far as numbers are concerned. The greatest salesman ever. He will go to people to take food with them or to drink with them. And that was the moment when he will try to infiltrate their being with his presence. That is his catalytic, magnetic power. When people are drinking, you have drunk a little bit, you become more relaxed. Then things are more easy. You are less defensive. Gurdjieff used to do that. That was his everyday work. Just as every day I go on talking to you, every day he used to invite his disciples for food. That was the greatest thing. Every day, every night. And it was not an ordinary dinner. It used to continue 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours, almost half the night, and then drinking. And he will force you to eat and drink, and he himself will be serving, and it will be difficult to say no. You will be less defensive, eating, drinking, laughing, and he will be telling jokes. And people will become very, very relaxed. The atmosphere will become very homely. Utterly homely. They will forget who is Gurdjieff and who they are. They will relax into his being and his work will start. That's exactly what I am doing. I go on talking to you. That is a kind of feast. Feast of words. You become involved in the words. You become utterly involved with the words. And my work, real work, starts. That is indirect. So first thing, first word to be understood about Christ is catalytic. He is not a great philosopher like Buddha. He is not a great scientist like Patanjali. He is not like a singer as Krishna is. But he has his own method. And that method is that he is a catalytic agent. In the East, there have been many masters like that. But Jesus is the ultimate in satsanga. Just being with people. The catalytic agent means that nothing is done to you, but something happens to you. The catalytic agent does not go into you and does not do anything into you, but just the very presence. Just the presence provokes you, inspires you. And something starts growing in you. Just as scientists say, if you want to make water, hydrogen and oxygen are needed, but they cannot meet unless electricity is present as a catalytic agent. It does not enter into them. It remains aloof, but its very presence helps them to meet. That is very miraculous. Science has not been yet able to know how the catalytic agent works, because nothing goes out of it. It is simply there. But you can understand it. Sometimes I am simply here, and something becomes silent in you. And this can happen even when you are far away. If you remember me, if you remember totally, immediately you will find something has changed. The vibe around you is no more the same. Something has fallen quiet, silent. The turmoil of the mind is a little far away, not so close by. You are settled and centered. Just the other day, somebody has asked a question that while I'm here listening to you and to your words, much is happening to me. But when I will go back, will it continue to happen when I will be listening to your tape or to reading your books? It depends on you. It can't depend on books, on tape. But it depends on you. If in those moments of listening to the tape or reading the book, you can feel my presence, you can visualize my presence, you can think of me and remember of me, it will go on happening. There will be no problem. Distance does not make much difference. For the first time, it is needed to be close. Once the contact has happened, then you can call me anywhere. And when I say you can call me anywhere, I mean you can simply fall into my presence anywhere. You can just remember me. Calm and quiet, remember me. Be full of my presence, and suddenly it will be there. And it will function as a catalytic agent. A catalytic agent is a miraculous thing. This is Jesus' real miracle. Tao has a word for it. They call it Wei Wu Wei. Action without action. The master does not do anything on you. He does not interfere in your being. He simply is there. But he is pulsating. And his pulsation is strong. His pulsation is vital. He is like a great wind which goes on blowing surrounding you. You are like a fragile tree. You start swaying in the wind. Something starts happening to you. The dance. The wind is invisible. And the wind, in fact, is not doing anything to you. It is simply blowing on its own way. But it can give you the thrill. It can wake you up. This is what acid people call contact high. It happens sometimes. Somebody has taken LSD. And is really deep into it, gone. And you are just taking care of the person. You have not taken LSD. You are just taking care of the person. Because it is dangerous to leave him. And suddenly you start feeling something is turning on in you. This is now a universal experience. Because so many people in this generation have taken LSD, marijuana, psilocybin and things like that. This is a universal experience now. that sometimes just being in the presence of somebody who has gone deep in his LSD trip, and you start feeling high, something starts moving in you. Wings grow, and you start flying. And you have not taken anything, then what is happening? Because that man's pulsation is so powerful in this moment. That man is blowing like a great wind. He takes you unawares with him. You are pulled by him. You are taken by his stream of consciousness. This is a new experience in the West, but in the East it is very ancient. And this is nothing because an LSD is LSD. Such a small quantity you take. But a Jesus is pure LSD. Just LSD and nothing else. He is made of the stuff LSD. A Buddha is absolutely marijuana. Each single cell of his body is a marijuana. It is not chemical, it is spiritual. It is such a vital force that there is no other force which is more vital. The only question is, if you become available to it, it turns you on. The second word is catalepsy. Suspension of your old being. When you are in contact with a Christ or a Buddha, your old being is immediately suspended. Out of the very shock, you cannot function as you used to function before. The very presence of the Christ is such a shock. Everything is suspended. For a moment, all thoughts stop. All feelings disappear. For a moment, you may miss a heartbeat. That's why it happens around great masters. You will see many people who look like zombies. They are in a kind of suspension. Just the other day, Divyananda came to me. He works in my garden. And he said, "What is happening to me? I have become almost like a zombie. And I am afraid. Should I go and do something else?" And I told him, "You be a zombie. Be a perfect zombie, that's all. You continue your work." Now something immensely valuable is happening, but he cannot understand it yet. This is what is happening, catalepsy. He is open to me. And working in my garden, he has become even more open to me. He is in a shock. He is forgetting who he is. He is losing his old identity. He is paralyzed. Why paralyzed? Because the old cannot function and the new has yet to be born. So he is in the interval. This is going to happen to many. Don't be afraid when it happens. It will go. It is not going to remain. But it is on the way. Happens. In the way it happens. This is a state of not knowing. You don't know what is what. Your all knowledge is lost. Your all cleverness is gone. You become idiotic. You look like an idiot. People will tell that you have become hypnotized or something. That you are no more your old self. That is true. But it is a kind of shock. And good. Because it will destroy the past. It will make you discontinuous with the past. And it will bring the fresh, the new. It will allow something original to happen. But before the original happens, the past has to go. You are like a pot in which there has been poison for long, for many years, for many lives. Now, before something can be poured into it, the poison has to be thrown out and the pot has to be cleaned, utterly cleaned. Even if a little bit of poison remains lingering around, it will destroy the new that is coming. It will kill it. That is the whole meaning of sannyas and disciplehood, that your past has to be completely washed away. Your memory, your ego, your identity, all have to go. When you are just an empty pot, then something more is possible. That is the third state, catharsis. When your head is in a shock, your heart becomes free. Because the head is not allowing the heart to be free. It is keeping the heart as a prisoner. When the head has stopped in a shock, and each master behaves you, cuts your head mercilessly, destroys your reason, destroys your logic, brings you down from the head, and the only way is to cut the head completely. This is the third state, catharsis. When the head is no more functioning, its control is lost, and the prisoner is free, and the heart starts throbbing again, maybe after many, many lives. And for many lives, you have been repressing your emotions, feelings, tears, love. They all flood you. That's what catharsis is. The appearance of the heart, the repressed explodes, an emotional outburst, kind of an earthquake or a heartquake, a volcanic situation. You are flooded by the unconscious and the irrational. That's why a real disciple always passes through a kind of insanity around a master. The fourth is catastrophe. When the reason is gone and the heart goes mad, it is catastrophe. And then the ego starts falling into pieces. Because the ego is nothing but the control. The control of the head on the heart is creating the ego. When the head is no more functioning, is in a shock, catalepsy, and the heart is in catharsis, the ego disappears because the ego is no more there. Cannot be there, the control is gone. And when the ego falls, it looks like catastrophe. All is lost. Chaos arises. And now one feels one has really gone mad. It is not just a temporary madness. It looks now it is going to remain there forever. One cannot look beyond it. This is what Christian mystics call the dark night of the soul. A kind of a hopelessness arises. One is utterly lost and there seems to be no possibility to get out of it. One is drowned and drowning. And the powers that are drowning is so vast that there seems to be no hope that you can get over them. The source are no more visible. You are in the middle of the ocean. And then comes the cross, the fifth. First the ego dies in the cross. In the fourth, it simply disintegrates, but goes on lingering in fragments, here and there, clinging. In the fifth, it dies the ego completely dies. No more identity with body or mind. A state of negation, death, emptiness, great trembling, fear. One is on the verge of the abyss called God. That is where Jesus found him on the cross. That cross has to come to everybody. Jesus says everybody has to carry his cross on his shoulders. Sixth, then comes conversion. Only when you are dead, God becomes alive in you. Only when the seed dies, it becomes a tree. Only when the river disappears into the ocean, it becomes one with the ocean. Conversion. Conversion is a beautiful word, very badly used by Christians. They think if somebody is a Hindu and becomes a Christian, this is conversion. This is not conversion. A Hindu becoming a Christian, this is nothing. He has simply changed one prison for another. One priest for another. One book for another. But there has been no real change, no transformation. A Christian can become a Hindu. Hindus think this is conversion. This is not conversion. Conversion happens only when the ego dies and God is born in you. Conversion is when human becomes divine. Not Hindu becomes Christian, or a Christian becomes Hindu, but when human becomes divine. When Jesus becomes Christ, then there is conversion. When Gautama becomes Buddha, then there is conversion. In the fifth cross, the ego dies. In the sixth, the self is born. The Supreme Self. The Atman. Your real self. For the first time, you know who you are. Mountains are again mountains. Rivers are again rivers. All confusion gone. Clarity arises. Your eyes become transparent. You can see things. Now there are no more any prejudices. And no more any ideologies. One is neither Hindu nor Mohammedan nor communist nor fascist. One simply is a purity of isness. This is where Hindus call Satyam Sivam Sundaram is felt. Satyam means truth. Sivam means good. And Sundaram means beautiful. Not before that. Before that, what you call beauty is nothing but lust. What you call good is nothing but conditioned morality. What you call truth is nothing but correspondence between you, your statement and things. Like you said, in the room there are three chairs. And somebody goes and finds three chairs. So it corresponds, it is true. This has nothing to do with truth. It is just correspondence. A true statement. But what about truth? What is truth? Three chairs? If there are two chairs, it is untrue. This is only linguistic and logical truth. Truth means that which is hidden behind the trees and the mountains, hidden behind people, hidden behind everything. That hidden becomes unhidden. Then you come to truth. Truth, and then you come to Shivam. Your life becomes good. Not in the sense of being a moral person, a Pharisee, a Puritan. No, your life becomes spontaneously good. Not that you try to do good, but whatsoever you do is good. You cannot do bad. The bad is impossible. Because you cannot think yourself separate from others, how can you do bad? You cannot hurt anybody because now hurting anybody is hurting yourself. Your ego is gone. You hurt somebody and you are hurt. You kill somebody and you are killing yourself. You steal from somebody and you are stealing from your own pockets. Now, goodness is just natural, not imposed, spontaneous and sundara. And only then, when you have known what is and you have become spontaneous, you can know what beauty is. Beauty is not only poetry. It is the vision of truth. It is the vision of God. But one step more. It is like you are 1,000 miles away from the Himalayas and you see in the early morning in the clear sky no clouds and the Himalayan peaks are standing there. Those virgin snows shining like gold in the morning sun. But you are 1,000 miles away. It is beautiful. It fills you with awe. But you are still distant. So in conversion, Satyam, Sivam, Sundaram, and then the seventh state is Christ consciousness. You are no more away from the peaks. You have become the peaks. You are no more away from those virgin snows. You are those snows. You are not seeing sun rays reflected on the snow. You are those sun rays. Christ consciousness is born. One becomes one with the whole. One becomes that which one really is. One becomes one with God. Buddha calls it Nirvana. Christ calls it Kingdom of God. Hindus call it Satchidanand. Now, again, another trinity arises. First, on the sixth, Satyam, Sivam, Sundaram. Truth, good, beauty. On the seventh, Sat, being, Chit, consciousness, Anand, bliss. Remember these seven words and meditate on them. Then you will be able to easily understand these immensely significant sayings of Jesus. And one of the Pharisees desired him that he would eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and sat down to meat. And behold, a woman in the city, which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment. This woman is Mary Magdalene. And stood at his feet behind him weeping, and began to wash his feet with tears, and did wipe them with the hairs of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Just the presence of Jesus, he walked on that street, he went into this Pharisee's house. And this woman, Mary Magdalene, heard. This was his first meeting with Magdalene. She was a prostitute. And something welled up into her heart. Sometimes it happens. Saints miss and sinners achieve. Because saints are very proud of their sainthood. The ego is strong. Now, a saint has not come to see Jesus, but a prostitute. Hearing that Jesus is so close by, knowing that he has come, maybe she had always dreamt and always wanted to see him, but was afraid. Maybe she is allowed or not. May have felt embarrassed. May have felt shy. What he will say, how she will stand before him. But she must have dreamed. She must have desired. Now the opportunity has come. And stood at his feet behind him weeping. Now she is standing behind. Weeping. This is the way to meet Christ. how can you encounter him from the front? It will be difficult to encounter him from the front. You will be dazzled. And encountering him from the front will be a kind of ego. No, one can meet Jesus only weeping. Because the meeting with Jesus is not of the head, but of the heart. And one can come only from the behind. Hesitant. Knowing perfectly well that I am not worthy. The more you feel that you are not worthy, the more worthy you become. The more you feel you are worthy, the less worthy you are. Because it is basically pride that hinders, nothing else. Rabbis won't go to Jesus. Saints won't go to Jesus. I have never heard, not a single story, that any saint went to see Jesus. How they can go? It is impossible. They would like Jesus to come to them. They cannot go. Their pride will not allow them. If sometimes some respected people have come to Jesus, they come hiding. One professor had come one night in dark when everybody had left. Because he was very respected. His name was Nicodemus. He was also a rabbi and a professor and a member on the board of the great temple. He was afraid to come in the daylight. People will come to know. And when people will see that he has come to see Jesus, then they will suspect his knowledge. So he is also following this madman. So he has also fallen into his trap. He comes dark in the dark night when nobody is there. But this woman of the street comes to see Jesus. She stands behind, is weeping, and began to wash his feet with tears. And when she comes in front of him, what she does? He washes his feet with tears. How else the feet of a Christ or a Buddha can be washed? You have to pour your heart. Those tears are nothing but her heart. She is crying, weeping. She is utterly happy too. She is sad about her past. She is repentant about her past, but she is utterly overjoyed too, because she has been able to come to Jesus. She has been able to touch his feet. She must have been afraid, because no saint would allow to touch, to be touched by a woman of the street. She must have been afraid. Jesus will say, "Woman, keep away." But he has not said anything. He is there, utterly sovereign in compassion on her, and began to wash his feet with tears, and did wipe them with the hairs of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisees, which had bidden him, saw it, he spake within himself, saying, "This man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that toucheth him, for she is a sinner." Now this woman is being transformed. And this Pharisee, this respectable man, is missing. He has invited Jesus, but he is not pulsating with him. Now his mind, his knowledge, his prejudice is coming in the way. He spake within himself. This man, if he were a prophet, now he knows the definition of a prophet. Everybody thinks he knows the definition of God, prophet, Messiah, Christ, Buddha. You have not ever looked into the eyes of a Buddha. You have never tasted of it. Just the other night, a sannyasin was saying to me that in the Vrindavan here, garlic and things like that, onions are used in food. These are harmful to meditation. As if he knows what meditation is. He has heard it. He runs a restaurant, so he knows about food, that is true. But he does not know anything about meditation. Who has told you that onions? Have you experimented? Just foolish ideas, fads, go on being given from one to another. One generation gives its foolishness to another generation, and the longer it has been transferred, the more. If you want to avoid apples, not onion. Because it is the apple who created the whole trouble. But that story also seems to be wrong, because I eat 3 apples every day. Just to see when God is going to expel me. He has not expelled yet. My doctor had told me when I was young that eat 1 apple a day and it keeps the doctor away. So I started eating 3, so it keeps everybody away. But God has not expelled me yet. And he seems to be very over-enjoyed with me. But onion, it was not even forbidden to Adam. And if garlic is the problem, then Maitreji will never enter the kingdom of God. Impossible. And he would not like either if he has to enter without garlic. Fads. You don't know anything about meditation. You don't know anything about Christ. You don't know anything about Buddha. But you have ideas. And you are not even hesitant. It seems natural for you, as it looked to the father, that was not that clever to time the horses so finely with the music. But to the little town, the horses are more important than the musicians. To little children, they live in a different world. Their perspective is different. He was not totally convinced of it. He said, what about timing the music with the horses? Rather than horses being timed with the music, it can be the otherwise. I love jokes. When I find a joke, I try to find an answer for it, a question for it. When I love a joke, and then sooner or later somebody or other is going to ask the question for which the joke is going to fit. The 7th question, what is meditation? Now this is strange. It reminds me of a story. A cricket fan took his girlfriend for a date. It was a full moon night. And the beach was silent. And they were sitting on the beach. And it was beautiful. They were holding hands and hugging each other. And the cricket fan continued to talk about cricket for 3 hours. Then suddenly he became aware that he must be boring the girl. 3 hours is too long. So he asked, "Sorry." He said, "Forgive me. I have been talking for 3 hours about my hobby. I am a fan. I am mad after cricket. I must have bored you utterly." The girl said, not at all. But do tell me, what is cricket? Now you ask, what is meditation? And my whole life, I have been talking about meditation. But still, I understand why the question arises. You listen, but you can't get it. You intellectually understand what is meditation, but still it remains elusive. You cannot catch hold of it. And you cannot catch hold of it. It is not that something is wrong with you. Meditation cannot be caught hold of. You have to allow it to happen so that it can catch hold of you. Meditation is not something that you have to do. Meditation is something for which you have to wait. It is something that comes and comes on its own. It is like a breeze. It is not that you can pull it in, that you can manage and order it. You cannot order anything that is valuable. Ordered things are ordered things. You cannot order God. So meditation, satori, samadhi, enlightenment, nirvana, God, they cannot be ordered. The very idea is silly. You cannot order. You can receive. Certainly you can receive. You can invite. You can wait in patience.